All right, let's open with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for your love. We thank you for your aggressive appearance in our lives, in our history, that you walked among us, that you lived in just everyday garb, that we could see the beauty and the deity that was inside your life, inside your smile, behind your hugs, behind your healing, behind your challenges in our lives, that we could see you and have an encounter with you. And we thank you that you came and just literally put that out in the public. You did it out there for all to see, that if we want to know what God is like, we can look at your Son. We would ask today, tonight specifically, that we would look at, you know, the work that you did, Lord, among us and among your people so long ago, and that we could learn from that and come away both amazed at your beauty and your goodness, and at the same time calmed because the accessibility, that we have a relationship with you, that you are approachable, that you do not fault us, that you are always accepting of us no matter where we are in our life and our relationship with you, that you're always encouraging us to move a little further, but you're not pushy. You're gentle, you're caring, and you're just perfect for us. We could never thank you enough for that. We do thank you for forgiveness. It cost you a lot at the cross. We understand this, and we pray that our lives would be filled with the same kind of love that showed itself there, that goes the distance. So bless our time tonight for your Son's sake. Amen. Okay, we're going to try our best tonight to get through Cana, two cities, Cana in Galilee and Capernaum. And those are, there's a couple of miracles in Cana of Galilee. The change of the water into wine is the most famous one that we're familiar with. And then Capernaum, of course, will be the headquarters of Jesus for most of his ministry, which is only going to be about 2.5, maybe 3 years. But they're going to operate out of Capernaum. And we're going to look at detail Capernaum because Peter lived there. We have Peter's house over there. We know where that is, the synagogue that Jesus healed people in. We've got a lot of data on Capernaum. And Peter and his brother live there, and James and John, they live there, and so it was a hub of commercial activity. Matthew, St. Matthew was a tax collector there, so it's a very important city that we're going to look at. We can only look at a couple of the things that happened there because there were so many. But we're going to jump right into Cana, and we will start on page 14 of our syllabus down toward the bottom in Cana of Galilee. And I only have one picture of Cana of Galilee, and it's only a distant shot I want to show. If you remember our little mantra here, here's our land of Palestine. And the distance, remember the short one from the top of the Dead Sea, to the Mediterranean, the short distance through Jerusalem was about 50 miles from Greenville to Greenwood. And then from the north there to the Sea of Galilee, where Capernaum is going to be up there, is the 70 miles from Greenville to Winona. So that's our distance there. That land is divided roughly into three areas. Now looking at it from a different sort of angle, the same thing. You have Judea, that sort of goes to right there, and you can see Jerusalem is right there. You have Samaria, which is basically a sort of like a despised area, the half-breeds, half-Jewish, half-non-Jewish. They were looked down upon. That goes to about here. And then up here is Galilee. The land of Galilee where Jesus grew up and most of his ministry occurred. You can see Nazareth is right there, his hometown where he grew up in. And Capernaum will be at right there at the Sea of Galilee. So those are the three areas where we've been operating most of the time so far in the Galilee. And it is called the Galilee is the name of the, it's called with the V. And you can see this was that valley that we've talked about where Armageddon occurs. And Megiddo is a fortress city there overlooking the plain. Major port sites, Acco, Ptolemais. A lot of trade comes in here, would go through these valleys over here to and then up to Syria. And Syria and Damascus is going to be up there. So we're up here in Galilee today. And now we're going to take and look at it from the west here. Now we're looking back from the Mediterranean Sea back over toward east. We're looking east. So this would be north, east, south, and west on our map. And we've been focused on Nazareth. We covered that the last time we were together. Sepphoris, we talked about, that's not mentioned in the Bible. That's that very, very large, the ornament of Galilee. Beautiful place. Jesus probably learned carpentry skills there, working with his dad, working with his family, would have seen Greek there. All the cultures of the world would have basically been there. And you can see the roads. These roads still exist. There's a road that comes from Ptolemais, Acco from the port that comes over here, goes through Sepphoris, but you can see one of the roads goes through Nazareth and will go south across these plains. Cana, where the wedding is going to be, is thought to be over there. So when Jesus goes to the wedding at Cana, he's going to be going from Nazareth. He's going to be basically going down the mountains into these plains, walking across these plains up here to Cana of Galilee. Capernaum, that we'll look at, is up there at the tip of the northern end of the Sea of Galilee. And while he's there at Cana, not at the wedding one, but the second miracle that's done in Cana, a royal official with a sick kid will come up these mountains and over these to ask Jesus to heal his son over in Capernaum, a royal official. There will be lots of royalty, powerful people in Capernaum, because that's a trade route, customs area, a center for Herod's kingdom. There'll be a lot of a Roman centurion is there. A lot of important people lived in Capernaum. And one of the more important ones, Basilikos, will come all the way up to Cana for the second miracle in Cana.
Glenn, how far was it from Nazareth to Cana?
About 9 miles. From Cana to Capernaum is about 20 miles. You know, it's a full day's journey, but from Nazareth to Cana is not a full day's journey. That's about a half a day's journey. Because you're going mostly downhill. Cana's right at the bottom of the foothill, sort of, right before you get to the plain. You didn't get all the way to the plain because of water gullies, stuff like that. So you built up just a little bit on the ridge there. So Cana will be right up there.
Could they go and spend the night or a night or two?
Well, normally that's what you would do in the ancient world. You would go with hospitality. I mean, one of the things you were required in the ancient world is when somebody showed up, you invited them in. And they stayed there with you until they convinced you to let them go. So the stories in the Old Testament, you have all the time, somebody's visiting a home, and they'll get up, and the host is sort of obligated to say, well, no, stay here for at least lunch. Get some good energy before you head out on your journey. And then they'll have the lunch, and they'll say, well, let's sit around and talk just a few more minutes. They'll visit. Now it's too late to leave. You got to have supper with us and stay overnight. And it'll go on 3 or 4 days. And that was sort of the custom back then. That's the way it worked. And you could never get anything done, you know. Normally, like I say, if you were wealthy enough to put people up, you had servants in the field, or generally what you had was your kids. They were the ones out there. You started farming when you were 7 and 8. You know, you were out in the fields, you know, like our families were, you know. You were out in the fields starting at 7 or 8 and specialized labor, and you know, everybody was working. That's why, because you had a carrying capacity of the land that you had to get this, you know, you had to make your numbers. You had to get the crops in, or else somebody didn't go hungry. You know, somebody was going to go hungry. It was going to be a lean year and you wouldn't have stuff to plant, you know, things of this type. So everybody was out there normally at the crack of dawn, except sometimes the head householder. But normally the patriarch, the family head, he would be out there too. You know, he's a manager. He's running the know, driving around his Ford truck or whatever, you know, he's a Ford Chariot, I guess, maybe, doing the farming and oversight stuff like that, unless there was company there, or unless he was one of the elders. If he was one of the elders of the city, he had a duty to go sit outside the gate, sit around, chew the fat, like the Odd Fellows Club. you would sit there, and when somebody wanted to sell their chariot to you or their horse to you, they would come up to this body of elders who were all witnesses, right? And all the business transactions and all the legal transactions were done in that assembly. They're all sitting around in a little crate, you know, chewing the fat, talking, doing the gossip, doing the stories, making plans for what they're going to do when Assyria invades, you know, all this kinds of stuff. And so that was the city government. Everybody did that. The witnesses were there. We have numerous cases where that's described in beautiful detail when Boaz marries Ruth. You know, there's a whole transaction there about the land, and he has a witness, and they have, and Jeremiah buys land, and he calls over a witness, and the scribe has to write it down, and things of this type. There were times where you had to be there just, you know, because it was your civic duty. But a lot of times that was in the heat of the day, you know, and a lot of times that would be a shaded area under a tree or something like that. Deborah judged Israel from under a palm tree, remember? You did have a lot of community things. And, of course, supper time, you know, in the smaller villages, you'd have the family, you'd have the community campfire. They would still do campfires from Bedouin days, where you would have everybody sit around and you would go over your ancestral stories. And so the young men would listen to the old men tell the stories of like Noah and the Ark. And Noah and the Ark is perfect parallelism. All the events, it's like a stair step. We studied it in Psalms when we did Psalms. It starts out with, God's judgment, and it goes all the way down. All the story goes down to a central point where the flood ends. And then it backs out in the exact same order as the other one. So you could theoretically come in anywhere and reconstruct what had gone on before you in the storyline. It's like repeating it and then going back over it backwards, you know, but still, and seeing that you know how it matches. It was called a chiasm. And they would tell at the campfire, and you can imagine the situations where some young upstart, you know, wants to tell his story for the first time, his version, knowing in great fear that the elders that have said this story for 40 years, the slightest mistake was going to, you know, get censure and stuff like that. So these are how a lot early on, in the times of Abraham, that some of these traditions would have been passed on, would be at the community campfire. And the Bedouins still have this as a tradition. This is how their, you know, their genealogies, or kids memorize the genealogies. I'm so-and-so son of, you know, all the way back, and things of this type. So, But the host, like I say, you would just stay there under their roof. Your animals would stay in the houses. When we looked at the houses, did you get the houses handout? Okay. It's right over here. But there was always a room that was for the animals on the floor. There were four rooms on the ground floor, and then you lived above it in two or three rooms up above it. But one of the things was for the animals, and that's where Mary and Joseph and Jesus, you know, born in a little trough, the feeding trough. That's where they would have had Jesus and things of that type. So this is Cana. Cana is the town where we're going to have these two miracles. One of Jesus' disciples, Nathanael, that we've already talked about. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? The reason he could say that, because he lives real close to Nazareth. You know, it'd be like us complaining about Indianola or Arcola or something like this, you know. So he knows Nazareth. Nazareth, remember, we'd already studied Nazareth, but Nazareth, remember, is where they had a Roman garrison of soldiers. And so, there were questions about Nazareth from that standpoint. Okay, so let's go through Cana and Galilee. Two miracles of Jesus and the home of Nathanael. We've already talked about Nathanael. He was a disciple of Jesus from Cana and Galilee. Okay, first bullet. Cana was a village in the hills of Galilee. You can see that there, it's there in the hills. Its exact location is disputed, but the best site seems to be that of Kirbet Cana, about 9 miles north of Nazareth. There's your 9 mile distance. It lay on a road that ran from Ptolemais on the Mediterranean coast, that Acco place that I talk about a lot, southeastward to Sepphoris, the center of Roman administration in Galilee, and thence southward toward Nazareth, to Samaria and Jerusalem. So it's real close to some trade routes, major trade routes, very, very close. It's obviously across the plain from Sepphoris. That's only going to be about a 5, maybe a 6 mile trek on flat land, which is easy to do with caravans and trade caravans and things of that type. Okay, next page. A village in Galilee noted as the location of Christ's first miracle, where at the marriage feast he turned water into wine. Following a period of travel, he again visited Cana. The only other mention of this place is in 2:21-2 as the home of Nathanael. There's also a village named Cana near Tyre, which was way north of Ptolemaea, so it's up the coast. Tyre and Sidon, very big famous cities, still are. Hence, it became necessary to designate the Cana of Galilee over against like the Cana of Sidon. As such, in order to identify its providence, the site being located some 8 to 9 miles directly north of Nazareth, and is so shown as on maps as in newer atlases. It is situated on the north end of the plain called Sal El Batuf, and that's this plain here that, you know, you see that flat land there, right? That's a beautiful plain there. Okay. The topography includes marshes, and the site, though not as yet excavated, shows potsherds from the Roman and Byzantine periods, together with some sherds and coins from the time of Christ. And a sherd is a piece of broken pottery. So if you take a vase, and when it breaks, it's either called a shard or a sherd, alternate spellings. And all you could do with a broken piece of pottery was use it to scrape things, or you could put mud on it and write things on it. So when they say they found a strata, which is the fancy word for sherd, they found something that they've written like a contract on. So I'd take a post-it. It'd be like a post-it. Pull it off, and I can't use it for much anything other than that. So I'd write down, you know, I sold my mule to Joseph Ben Tolley, you know, whatever. And so sherds always have some kind of, you know, symbols or something like that. We have a very famous one that's got an ABCDary on it. ABCDarius, I think that's how it's said, where somebody's trying to teach a kid or somebody the ABCs of Hebrew. And so it's got the letters on that. You don't know, and the letters are halting, you know, so it looks like maybe it's a kid that's having to write their ABCs, their Aleph, Bet, Gimels in Hebrew, you know, this kind of thing. And so you use the sherds for notes and things of that type, but there was nothing else you could do with it. Biblical usage talks about, when it wants to talk about how useless something is, they talk it as a cracked pot. You know, it's supposed to hold water, you know, and that's what, you know, broken vessels, right? Let's see. Okay. Here's the text. The next bullet is from John 2. This was the wedding story. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now, both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Now there were set there 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. So half a 55-gallon drum. Jesus said to him, "Fill the water pots with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast." And they took it. When the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water, they knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom. And he said to him, "Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior wine. You have kept the good wine until now," which means it was later in the feast when this occurred. And they're about out of wine. Okay? Next book. Oriental wedding feast often lasted 7 days. So the wedding party was not a night affair or an afternoon reception. It was a week, like I say. When you went to all the trouble to get somewhere, you know, that you had to do, you stayed there for a while. So 7 days. The feast followed the groom's taking of his bride to his home or his father's home before the consummation of the marriage. So this was, you didn't even have your wedding night until after the 7 days. You had the ceremony, okay, and then you had 7 days of partying, and then you went on your honeymoon, okay. When the supply of wine was used up, Mary turned to Jesus in hope that he could solve the problem. Did Mary expect a miracle? In the light of verse 11, which says that this is the first of the miracles he did, this is not likely, because Mary had not yet seen any miracles done by her son, right? She just knew that he did things. You know, he was a problem solver somehow. So she brought the problem to him. Even though she couldn't figure out how God was going to answer this prayer, you know, she nonetheless asked, right? The word woman applied to his mother may seem strange to a modern reader. Why didn't he say something like, Mom, this is not my time, instead of just woman, right? But it was a polite, kind expression. Compared 19:26, when Jesus is up on the cross, remember, he says, when Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved, that's John, he loved standing beside her, he said to his mother, Woman, here is your son. And then he said to the disciple, Here is your mother. And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own home. So that was sort of like an adoption kind of thing where he said, Woman, here's your son. It was a double, John is full with these double entendres where what he says means two things. You're supposed to catch them both. So when Jesus tells Nicodemus, you must be born again, the word also means born from above. And so, it means both of us. It's not either one of them, and you'll hear preacher go off on either one of those, and they're both right, but they're both important because it's a double entendre. It's not only mentioned that you got to have renewal, but it's also got to come from God. It can't just be you whipping yourself into a frenzy to be better. It's got to be a spiritual experience. And so this one has got, woman, behold your son. She's looking at her Jesus up on the cross while he's talking about John. And then says to John, behold your mother. And so there's a double entendre about look where you are. You know, I'm up here dying for your sins, Mom, right? And I'm also at the same time providing for your future. Because as the oldest son, it was his job to take care of the rest of the family, basically. We think that Joseph, his father, passed away probably in 13, 14, maybe 15 years of age. Because he shows up at 12 and he's not mentioned again in any of these events. I mean, Jesus is still called the son of Joseph, but you would call him that whether Joseph was alive or not. So, but he doesn't show up. So Jesus would have had actually family responsibilities to carry the family, you know, from somewhere in mid-teens. And his decision to go into a traveling ministry, see, would have been a very tough choice. He would have had to, of course, at that point he has all these brothers and sisters that are capable themselves of doing this, James and John, and there's a number of James and Judas, Jude. But he's still taking care of his mom. However, the clause, why do you involve me, was a common expression in Greek that referred to a difference in realms or relations. In other words, there's something different about when somebody says to you, what has this got to do with me? That says there's something different about the two of us. About whatever we're about or our responsibilities. Demons spoke these words when they were confronted by Christ. When Christ, they'll say, what do you want with us? What do we have to do with you? In other words, we're in different spaces here. We have different concerns. So what do you want with me? Mary had to learn a painful lesson, namely that Jesus was committed to God the Father's will, and the time for his manifestation was in the Father's hand. It wasn't Jesus' choice, basically, when he wanted to do a miracle. He had to sense that it was an act of obedience to the God the Father. God the Father was said, Jesus later said, I don't do these things of my own initiative. God the Father shows me what he's doing here, and I make myself available to take part in that. He shows me everything he's doing. And that was what Jesus' role in this was. He did not sense, per se, directly that God the Father was about going to take care of this wine problem. That's the first appearance, okay? My time has not yet come, or similar words, occurs five times in John. And later, the fact that his time had come is mentioned three times. My time has not yet come, and then now my time has come. Mary's response to the servants, do whatever he tells you, reveals her submission to her son. Even though she did not fully understand, she trusted him. And she's just like every other one of us. We don't know a lot about this, you know, but we know enough to trust him. We don't know how he's going to get us out of some of these problems or stop us from certain things or change us or something like this. But we know just if we could sort of get there and ask him, you know, and trust him, that it's his job to be the shepherd. I'm just the sheep, right? So she trusted him. She didn't fully understand what he even said. It's a good question. She didn't even catch what he was talking about. But she said, I don't know. Just whatever he says, do. She turns to the servant. She knows where some relief can occur. The water in the 6 water jars, 20 to 30 gallons each, was used for Jewish purification rites before and after meals. In other words, the big Pharisees and the holier than thous, they always had all these washings. You know, and they would always wash before they ate, and they washed after they ate, and they were always cleaning themselves, like really good obsessive compulsives would do. You know, they're always doing this kind of stuff, you know. And so their jars here for purification rites. So that means that whoever's in here is a little religious, at least they're catering to a religious crowd. The contrast between the old order and the new is evident. In other words, the fact that the old order's got water for cleaning, and the new thing that Jesus does, he turns that into wine for joy and a celebration of newness and a wedding and things of this type. That shows the difference between one always having to get forgiveness of sins and the other one being free to actually enjoy forgiveness of sins and go out and enjoy our Father's world. Probably the water jars were outside the banquet. Normally you'd keep them out. The master of the banquet, he's like a butler or steward, maybe even an MC, but he's also got, you know, he's in charge of it. He's the caterer, you know, that's going to run the show, so to speak. In charge of the festivities would not know he was drinking from the purification jars. Remember, because he was outside, they gathered this ladle and scooped it up, took it in. He would have known where the liquid came from. For a Jew, this would be unthinkable for him to drink out of that. If he'd known, he would have pushed back and said, nah, sorry, I don't do that. You know, that's dedicated to this other kind of thing. The servant dipped out the water, which had become wine. As the master of the banquet tasted the wine, he found it to be superior to what they had been drinking. In contrast with a common custom in which the best wine was served first and the lesser quality later, he affirmed that this wine served last was the best. Significance of this miracle is that Christianity is in advance over Judaism. God has kept the best gift, his son, until now. He had started out with Moses and he had started out with the prophets, and every one of those increases the beauty of God's message. Later in the prophetic thing, you get Jeremiah that talks about the new covenant, when I will put my spirit in your heart. Joel, the blessings of God in the future get bigger and bigger with every succeeding generation of prophet. And finally, as Hebrews says in first couple of verses, God, who at various times in the past spoke to our fathers in various means, hath in these last days spoken to us in his Son, who is the express caricature, and the word is character, the express caricature, the way you would draw a picture of something, the express caricature of the Father. If you wanted to see in flesh and blood what God looked like, you looked at the Son. Okay, the prophets talked about the Son, said he was going to be a suffering Messiah, he was going to be a victorious Messiah, he was going to be a priest, he was going to be a king, he was going to be royalty, he was going to be a pauper. He's going to be all these things to all people, right? And so the advance is when you, the other kind of illustration, you don't pour new wine in old wineskin. This is, again, there's something bigger is here because it's going to explode through the kingdom. 2:11, the significance of the miracle was explained by John as a manifestation of Christ's glory. In contrast with the ministry of Moses, who turned water into blood as a sign of judgment, Jesus brings joy. His first miracle was a gracious indication of the joy which he provides with the Spirit. The sign points to Jesus as the Word in the flesh, who is the mighty Creator. Each year he turns water to wine in the agricultural and fermentation processes. Here he simply did the process immediately. Just did it. He's the Creator. He's the Word. Just went. The 120 gallons of fine wine were his gift to the young couple. The first miracle, a transformation, a change from something old to something new, pointed to the kind of transforming ministry Jesus would have. Not victorious overthrow, not forcing us to change, but changing us from the inside out, changing us little by little in our hearts as we make our hearts available to him. All right, Cana may be Kephar Cana, over 3 miles from Nazareth, but most scholars prefer Kirbet Cana, over 8 miles from Nazareth, which is the one we're looking at on this map. Either site would be close enough to Nazareth to explain how the host knows Jesus' family. Okay? Weddings lasted 7 days, and host invited as many people as possible, especially distinguished guests like prominent teachers. So if there was a visiting rabbi, you would make sure you invited a prominent rabbi. And so it says Mary was there. She might have been working there as part of the family. Okay. But Jesus and his disciples were invited. Okay. So, prominent teachers, perhaps. To run out of wine at a wedding was a social faux pas that would become the subject of jest for years. They'd make fun of you for years in these villages. The host was responsible to provide his guests with adequate wine for 7 days. It's just, you had to do it. There were no options. You didn't have the feast if you couldn't do that. To do it and run out was just reprehensible. You'd be talked about, you know, as the short wine person, you know, whatever, you know, the cheap wedding, you know, whatever, dude, you know, in these small little towns the rest of your life. The woman's quarters were near the place where the wine was stored. Thus, Mary learns of the shortage of wine before word reaches Jesus and the other men. So she's aware somebody's saying, uh-oh, and they hear over there where they're partying. Most of the time they partied separately, but sometimes they would party together with the men. Her words probably suggest that to Jesus that he should do something, because guests were to help defray the expense of the wedding with their gifts. See, you're supposed to bring a wedding gift, and that's supposed to help offset this huge banquet that you're supposed to be doing. It's not a gift to the couple, per se, like, you know, a bread maker they take home with them. You know, this is actually, you know, and it's not like a potluck where you brought the own wine, you know, but it's monetary gifts or a sheep or cattle that you could turn into money to offset, you know, when the invoice came for all the wine or whatever, right? And it seems that their friend needs some extra gifts now. You know, they're run out of wine. Woman was respectful dressed like ma'am, but hardly customary for one's mother. Jesus' statement here establishes the polite distance. Though what I have to do with you is usually a harsh, not a polite expression. What have I got to do with you? Because Jesus' hour in John refers especially to the cross. Here Jesus is saying, once I begin doing miracles, I begin the road to the cross. You know, it cuts the timer on. Once I do that first miracle and I manifest the Father's glory in this way, right now I'm just going to be a hidden teacher. I'm going to teach you what's right about God and stuff like that. But the day is going to come where I'm going to start this outbreaking of the kingdom, where the kingdom of God is going to start erupting, as they call it, into our world. And when that occurs, all heaven and earth, all the forces of heaven and earth are going to be against me, and we're going to go to the cross in their time. 2:5. Like many Old Testament seekers of God. Oh, yeah. Seekers of God who would not take no for an answer. Mary acts in confidence that Jesus will hear her entreaty. This is one of the standard Old Testament things where somebody will go to God and say, please do this, and God says, well, no. And then they stay on and say, okay. God says, okay. They ask a second time, and God jumps at the opportunity because they've shown their faith or their persistence or they really believe it or something of that, or transforms them into people that stay after God. And she does the same thing right here. Says, yeah, I'm sure he said this obscure saying to me, but he didn't say actually no. I noticed this. He didn't say yes or no here. So let me just, I'll go out in faith. Mary acts in confidence that Jesus will hear her entreaty. Ancient Jewish readers who told stories of miracle workers who insisted that God would send rain would read Mary's action as demonstrating strong faith. The rabbis had this one, Anina, a powerful prayer warrior, to where he says, they come to him and say, pray for rain for the land. This is after the destruction of Jerusalem. They're out of the land. And Hanina draws a circle and stands and says, God, I'm not going to leave this circle until it rains on the land. And he stays there, you know, for, we don't know how long he stayed. I think it was like a day and a night. And then God looked and said, okay, I did rain. That guy's serious, so we're going to do the rain. And so persistence in prayer, just staying after God, you know, is what they would have seen this, the readers. 2:6, the description of the stone jars indicates that they contained enough water to fill a Jewish immersion pool used for ceremonial purification. So a ceremonial pool would be like a pit, a square, rectangular, cubic kind of pit in the ground that, you know, it would only hold 100 gallons or so like it. So it wouldn't be really big, but it'd be enough to like do a little baptismal kind of thing to immerse pots or yourself in some cases. They didn't do a lot of baptisms back then, but sometimes you did, especially when non-Jews came over into the Jewish faith. You would do a proselyte baptism sometimes. But it'd be large enough to do an immersion pool for ceremonial purification. Although Pharisees forbade storing such water in jars, you weren't allowed to actually do that, some Jews were less strict. Thus, these large jars were being reserved for ritual purposes. In other words, it was sometimes hard. In the Old Testament, you're supposed to use running water to clean things, not standing water. And for obvious sanitation reasons, I mean, you know, the ancient world just used bowls and stuff like that. But you were supposed to use pouring water, moving water for this. Stone jars were common because they were less likely to contract ritual uncleanness than those made of other substances. So if you had a wineskin, for example, or a boda bag that was made of a skin of an animal or something like this, it could get a mildew. It could get a blotch or something like this that counted as uncleanness, where it's much harder to get that on pot clay pots. Using the jars for another purpose other than ritual cleansing would temporarily defile them, though. And drinking out of them, for example, would be verboten. Jesus shows more concern for his friend's wedding than for contemporary ritual. In other words, when push comes to shove, God will always opt for people instead of religion. He will always go for people before he gets to religion or procedure. You know, he will take an option there. Next page, master of the banquet was a position of honor. One of his primary duties was to regulate the distribution of wine to prevent excess that would, especially in a Jewish context, ruin the party. At least in Greek banquets, guests elected this person to preside over the entertainment and to control the level of dilution for the wine. Thus, some observers might have held him partly responsible for the host running out of wine prematurely. It was his job to cut with water the wine. He was supposed to dilute it. This stuff was very highly diluted anyway. It wasn't like the kind of wine you'd buy at a liquor store now. Very diluted, but it was his job to make sure the stuff stretched. His job to make sure it stretched. Soon after the grape vintage, all wine would contain some alcohol. I mean, instantly, neither refrigerating nor hermetic sealing existed back in those days. It's going to start fermenting immediately, as soon as you pluck it off the thing, whether you like it or not. But the alcohol level of the wine was not increased artificially. Distillation was not in use. In other words, you didn't boil it so that, you know, the non-alcohol boiled off so you got more liquor on a percentage basis. A thicker thing, like you would in distillation processes and the old stills and all that stuff. Rather, the wine was watered down with 2 to 3 parts water to 1 part wine. So that's not very, you know, alcoholic at that at all. Most of the wine was for flavoring and also for medicinal purposes. When Paul writes to Timothy in the New Testament, and he's telling him to do this and do that, don't do this, do this. And he says, and stop drinking just water. Take a little wine because of your often infirmities. That's what he tells him. He says, you've got to start drinking something that's going to kill the germs or something. I don't know how you did this. You know, what the thing was. He said, you need to be drinking a little bit of wine in your diet because you get sick all the time. And, that was part of what this would have been in addition to just the alcoholic thing eventually would have, you know, affected him, things of this type. Sometimes at Greek parties, drunkenness was induced through less dilution or the addition of herbal toxins. It put stuff in the wine or make it thicker so you'd get drunk. But Jewish teachers disapproved of such practices. That drunkenness is part of the celebration at Cana is unlikely. One would normally serve the better wine first because, drunk or not, guest senses would become more dulled as the 7 days of banqueting, you know, continued. So it's not that you serve the good wine where they could still taste it, and now that they're drunk, you give them the cheap stuff, you know, fig ripple, you know, whatever. You know, it's not like that, because now they're so drunk they don't care. It's that, you know, they've been drinking wine now for 7 days, you know, and they're sort of tired of it, you know, it's fine. This will perk them up a little bit, and you know, they'll keep going. 2 to 3. The disciple group invited with Jesus would have been viewed as Jesus' family, for whose contributions to the marriage feast he would have been responsible. Disciples were considered the sort of like the family of their rabbis. You know, the rabbis are sometimes called fathers, and they're sons of the rabbis, the disciples are. They would have been seen, and they would have been responsible to make contributions. You know, remember, everybody came and brought a little money, chipped into the kitty for the party. It is natural assumption that this is what motivated Mary's drawing the attention of Jesus to the lack of wine. Not that she hoped for a miracle, but that his presence with the disciples, jointly embarked on a mendicant ministry, which is a begging ministry, which means I don't carry money for such parties. I don't have money. Jesus didn't have money, and his disciples didn't have money, but they came to this feast anyway, and it was sort of their responsibility to do something. So she turned to him, which rendered them unable to fill the obligation of guests, contributed to the embarrassing situation. So she just brought this to his attention, that they're out of wine, and normally you and your disciples were expected to help. So, like, what are you going to do about it? You know, that kind of thing. That could have been a part of the thing. To me and to you is a well-known but ambiguous expression which can express a hostile or a peaceful intent. That is the what is it to you or me, woman? What has that got to do with me? That's the expression. 2 Kings 3:13 is of interest as an example of it, in that it expresses rejection. You know, what has that got to do with me? Yet the prophet gives what is asked, just like Jesus does. So somebody comes up and asks the prophet for, favor, and the prophet gives them what has that got to do with me? But nonetheless, you know, answers the prayer. It's just a perfect analog here to Jesus in his prophetic role. So here is an apparent rejection of Mary's initiative, yet the granting of the request anyway. You know, it looks like he's a little standoffish, but he doesn't say no. But then he goes ahead and answers yes anyway, and probably way beyond what her expectation was. She wouldn't have expected him to contribute 120 gallons of the best wine. You know, that would have been a little overkill. The question may, however, have a gentler tone. An analogical expression from East Syrian Chaldean suggests not division, but unity of thought, which can be rendered, why are you speaking to me about this need? With you, I already understand this. In other words, why are you talking? Why did you mention this? You know, I already know this. I'm already concerned. So it could also mean that. That's another possible understanding of the phrase. Gunai, the word woman, has caused needless perplexity. While it is an unusual mode of address to one's mother, it also may be affectionate, apart from John 19:26, which cannot be intended to express distance. That's where she, on the cross, woman, behold thy son. A significant occurrence of the term is found in Josephus, Antiquities 17:71. This is particularly pretty, in my opinion. The wife of Pheroras tells Herod the Great how her husband summoned her in his illness. In other words, Pheroras is sick, and he's not doing well, and he calls for his wife, beginning his statement with woman. Calls for his wife with woman. This example is important since Pheroras had great affection for his wife. It's just, this is a recognition beyond honey, you know, or sweetie pie. This is woman, my partner, woman. He truly has great affection for the wife and uses that term because of the severity of the situation. He refused Herod's request that he send her away. And Herod said, you know, she came when he beckoned her. And Herod said, you need to send her away. And he refuses to do that because of this affection for this woman, his wife, and his persistence in keeping her led to a rupture of relations between the two men. Herod the Great was the ruler of that period, and Pheroras is not did not have the same level of power, but because of his great affection for this woman, his wife, he risked that the rupture with Herod. 2-3. A wedding is always a gala occasion, and in a village like Cana, it would be a community celebration. Everybody would have gone there. Refreshments were provided for all guests. Of these, wine was very important. To fail in providing adequately for the guests would involve social disgrace. In the closely knit communities of Jesus' day, such an era would never be forgotten. You might end up in a campfire story, you know, next week. This is the story of old John, you know, who ran out of wine before we had fun or what, you know, whatever. And would haunt the newly married couple all their lives. The situation prompted Mary's urgency when she informed Jesus of the emergency. This really was a big deal to these folks. Jesus' reply to Mary was not so abrupt as it seems. Woman, gunai, was a polite form of address. Jesus used it when he spoke to his mother from the cross, and also when he spoke to Mary Magdalene after the resurrection. So he's risen, and she comes, and he says, "Woman, why are you weeping?" You know? And so it's an affectionate term. It's not a negative term. Two translations of Jesus' rejoinder to his mother are possible. What business is that of ours, meaning mine and the disciples, or what authority do you have over me? In other words, why are you making this request to me? You can't command me to do this. The second alternative is based on the analogy of the question of the demoniac. What do you want with us, Son of God? Which employs exactly the same phrase. In the Greek, it's the same phrase. Since Jesus' mother expressed neither surprise nor resentment at such an answer, the former translation is probably more acceptable in this instance. What do you want me to do about it? Or, you know, she acknowledged that he should act independently, and she confidently told the servants to follow his orders. She fully expected that he would take appropriate action. Okay, now that's the first miracle that he did in Cana of Galilee. Now the second one is this next break, next passage. And this is later in his ministry, okay? After two days, this is in Jerusalem. This is in Samaria. Earlier in John 4, he's witnessed and shared with the Samaritan woman, that despised of despised, right? And after 2 days there, he goes into the town of Sychar. They all accept the Lord. They welcome him there into the Samaritan town. He stays with them at least 2 days. Then after 2 days, he left for Galilee, goes north to Galilee. Now, Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. When he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover feast. In other words, the Galileans had gone south for the party too, for the Passover, just like Jesus would have gone. Okay, they would have seen the miracles that he did at Jerusalem. He did some miracles there. And so, but they hadn't seen him do miracles before. So they return home. He returns home. And so now they say, "Hey, do some of that stuff we saw down south." Okay. They had all seen what he'd done in Jerusalem in the past, for they also had been there. Once more, he visited Cana in Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine. There was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. So over here at Capernaum, there's a royal official, works for Herod probably. He's got a sick son. And he comes to, when the man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son who was close to death. "Unless you people see miraculous signs and wonders," Jesus told him, "you will never believe." The royal official said, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus replied, "You may go, your son will live." The man took Jesus at his word and departed. While he was still on the way, so now he's left, he's here. You know, the royal official goes up 20-odd miles, uphill, long trek, discouraged. He's already exhausted all his resources in Capernaum, the big city. Now he's going to this hick town, right, because he had heard of this healer, miracle, somebody. And then Jesus tells him, "Go home, your son will be better," and then he returns back the way he came to Capernaum, and he's got this journey. The man took Jesus at his word and departed. While he was still on the way in that 20-mile journey, his servants met him coming up from Capernaum with the news that his boy was living. When he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said, the fever left him yesterday at the seventh hour. When the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, your son will live. So he and all his household leave. All his household would have been all his family and all the servants in the household. People living there. Because they were all basically an extended family. You all lived and worked together. And so they all shared the same perspective. The Galileans hoped Jesus would duplicate the signs they had witnessed in Jerusalem while they were attending the Passover feast. They were disappointed to discover that Jesus had no intention of exhibiting his powers to satisfy their curiosities. This was not a circus. The reason for revisiting Cana, going back to Cana, is not given. It may be that Jesus expected to find some disciples who had believed on him after the miracle at the wedding. It'd be a logical choice, you know, because word would have spread about this miracle, and that surely somebody would be there that remembered this in just, you know, a year, maybe, that were disciples. Could be. The royal official, Basilikos, may have been a member of Herod's court. His son had been healed for some time and was not recovering from his sickness. Therefore, the father felt compelled to seek some further aid. It is possible that the official was a Gentile. Remember, Herod had Jews and Gentiles on his payroll. So it's possible he was a Gentile. If so, the three persons Jesus interviewed in his early ministry in the Gospel of John represented the Jews, the Samaritans, and the Gentiles. In short, the world he came to save. He's just gotten through with the Samaritan woman in John 4. He's already been to Cana, which were Jews, and now he's got Cana. He did Nicodemus in John 3. Okay, Nicodemus was a rabbi, holy person. Then he goes up, he does the Samaritan woman, and if this guy's a Gentile, then he's covered all the categories of the people he came to reach, all of us. In short, the world he came to save. John's gospel, though it chronicles chiefly the ministry of Jesus in Jerusalem, has a much wider horizon than the area of his residence. In other words, Jesus may live and have grown up, been a hometown boy in Galilee, okay, but his outreach is the whole world. He came to save the world. When he appears, John the Baptist, down south in Jordan, and John walks up to John the Baptist, who's his older, like second cousin or something like this. John the Baptist points to him, all the crowds around, says, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Not the sins of Israel, but the sins of the world. Now, this opening phrase in John's ministry is that Jesus came to die, not to rule over the Romans, not to restore. He'll do all of those, but he came to give his life as a sacrifice to save us. 47, the report that Jesus had healed people in Jerusalem must have reached this man's ears. News travels fast, good news or bad. The information flow is amazing that occurs in the ancient world. I've been reading about this for 10 years. It's amazing how fast stuff gets around, trade caravans. I mean, it's amazing the networks of information that was available for them. The report that Jesus must have reached this man's ear, especially as a Herod's official. Remember, Herod wants to hear. Herod knows about the miracles of this Jesus. Remember, he's the superstitious one. Puts John the Baptist, you know, in the jail. He thinks Jesus is John the Baptist come back from the dead. He wants Jesus to walk across the swimming pool, you know, at the trial. I mean, he wants to see some kind of miracle. So Herod collects these stories. You know, so Herod's court sensitized. I'm sure it was probably worth a cost of living pay raise if you had a good miracle story to tell Herod, you know, your boss. You know, so you never know about that. But he heard about it. Learning that Jesus had returned to Galilee, the man immediately sought Jesus out and urged him to heal his son. He was dangerously ill. The imperfect tense of the verb begged implies repeated or persistent action. The imperfect tense would have been he was begging. He was interceding. He was continually beseeching Jesus. The request was not casual, but insistent. Just like that Mary, you didn't give up on the first time. You just kept pleading. You kept asking. You kept knocking on that door. Those that continue knocking, God opens to. The reply of Jesus seems like a heartless rejection. Jesus, you know, he says this. He says, unless you people see signs and wonders, you won't believe. And it's a plural. It's not like you. He's addressing the crowd around. He may not even been talking to that guy. You know, they might have just used this as an occasion because all these other people, they were just wanting to see a show. This guy had a real issue. He had a kid at home. See, he wasn't interested in miracles. He wasn't going to travel 20 miles away from the job just to see somebody do a parlor trick. You know, there's a difference in the crowd as to how, and it always is with Jesus' crowds. You know, there's some people there that want the glory, they want the free food, they want something. You know, but there's some people there, like the woman with the hemorrhage, you know, the internal bleeding for all those years, you know, and she just wanted to touch him and be well. You know, she didn't, and ran away, tried to get away. So, the reply of Jesus seems like a heartless rejection. He seemed to insinuate that the official, like the rest of the Galileans, was only given an excuse for eliciting a miracle. Like he was just, you know, trumping up this fake miracle thing to do something. On the other hand, Jesus' words may express his hope more than his exasperation. And as he's hoping that this might be different than the rest of the crowd that is just looking at it like a miracle. He desired a belief characterized by dedication rather than amazement. He just doesn't want, you know, to believe just because he does miracles and, you know, he can do tricks. And the second half of the episode shows that his aim was to inculcate a genuine commitment rather than merely perform a cure. He never seemed to just do a cure just for a cure. If he couldn't turn that into a transforming experience for the people around him, he didn't do it. I mean, he couldn't. There was plenty of sick folk in Palestine. The issue was there an opportunity to create that water out of wine? You know, is there an opportunity there? There are occasions where he did it where there was zero faith there. We'll not cover it because I won't get that far in this syllabus. But there's a story where somebody had been sick at the pool of Siloam for 40 years, had no hope whatsoever, and did what Jesus did, said probably just so he could snitch on him, tell the authorities and get some free food out of them. Probably base motives. So even in those cases, which is encouragement to us, God still acts on their behalf. The genuine distress of the father is demonstrated by his words, "Sir, come down at once before my little boy dies." The use of the aorist tense of die to imply the impending crisis is in contrast with the present tense in 47, which describes the progress of the illness. This indicates that the case was pretty desperate. Jesus' response still seems somewhat impersonal and casual. By dismissing the official with a statement that his son was alive, Jesus created a dilemma of faith. Now, so like Mary, he stays after Jesus. One more time, he says, please, you know, you said this thing. Somebody else is going to point out that he did not have the heart to engage in a theological discussion with Jesus about miracle seeking and belief and stuff like this. He just pressed the case. And then Jesus said, go thy way. That son lives. That's all he says. It could seem like impersonal or something like this, but look what he did here. By dismissing the official with a statement that his son was alive, Jesus created a dilemma of faith for the official. If the father refused to return to Capernaum without tasting Jesus with Mary, he came to bring Jesus home, right? But if he goes without taking Jesus to him, if he stays there and won't go without bringing Jesus, he would show that he did not believe Jesus' word that he just said. Okay? Jesus just said, go your way, your son's alive. And if he stayed there and says, no, you gotta go with me, he shows that he really didn't believe what Jesus just said. Right? He would consequently really receive no benefit because of his distrust. On the other hand, if he followed Jesus' order, he would be returning to the dying boy with no outward assurance, not a scrap of evidence, that the lad would recover. He was forced to make a difficult choice between insisting on evidence and thus showing disbelief and of exercising faith without any tangible proof to encourage him. Right, that's a tough one. He's already heard the stories now, and he didn't get to be a basilikos by being a gullible person, okay? He's a high-ranking official. He knows, you know, somebody's blowing smoke, you know, and these kind of stories. The official chose the second horn of the dilemma. He took Jesus at his word and set out on his return journey. He learned faith by the compulsion of necessity. People are amazed by coincidences, and generally they do not attribute them to direct activity of God. They'll say, boy, that's odd. You're born on the same day, you know, as my dog. you know, whatever. The official took a chance and went home as Jesus had commanded him, and a miraculous report greeted him. While he was still on the way, there is an interesting progression in the description of the boy's condition. First, the news came that his boy was living. But more than that, the man was curious to know the time when his son got better. He's been thinking about this. See, he's thinking there's maybe something more here than accident. And just for what it's worth, in the ancient world, you didn't get well. When you got sick, you died. Mortality was so high. When you got sick, you generally died. There were no physicians, were fairly useless back at this stage of history. And so it's odd enough that his boy was living, but he wants to know a little bit more about this. Finally, he was told the fever left him yesterday at the seventh hour. When the father considered the details of his meeting with Jesus and the good news concerning his son's recovery, he was convinced that it was more than coincidence at work. The timing was miraculous, and the boy's recovery was more than even circumstances could have brought about. Now, notice that it never ever said that Jesus healed this boy. He just said, go your way, your son lives. Right? Right. And so it's this guy that has to jump across that gap and say, whoa, he didn't even say anything and it happened over the distance. In other words, you see it, and it's crystal is clear to this guy. It's just too odd that God answered this prayer, right? The timing was just ridiculous, as you know, to be circumstantial. Okay, 4:46. Capernaum was close to a full day's walk from there, Cana. Royal official probably means that this man is one of Herod Antipas' court officials, although Herod's official title was Tetrarch rather than King, but people called him King. Jesus was extremely unfavorable toward Antipas, this man who comes to Jesus would be a wealthy aristocrat, probably much influenced by Greco-Roman culture. In other words, he knew all that. He wasn't very Jewish and not very religious by general Palestinian Jewish standards. He wouldn't have been a rabbi, wouldn't have been a Pharisee. You know, he would have been probably looked down upon by the Jewish, you know, religious elite. Come down is more accurate than come, because Capernaum on the Sea of Galilee was lower in elevation as Cana. You can see that from the map. So he says, come down and heal my son. And down means down the mountainside. Long distance miracles were rare by Old Testament, other Jewish and Greco-Roman standards. In other words, you did not heal at a distance. You just didn't do miracles like this at a distance. People generally believed that prophets and Greek magicians believed them more easily if they were present in person. That's why they always start with, come down. You know, the Roman centurion later will say, please come down, my servant is sick. He'll start with that. He'll change it as Jesus gets approached, because he'll realize what's going on. He'll say, actually, you don't need to come down because you have authority. I mean, distance is no issue to you. I'm a soldier. I have direct reports. I tell them go here and they do it. So you don't even need to come down. My house is not even worthy of you to walk in. So just do it from where you're standing. And that's faith. See? But generally, you expected a healer to come and lay hands on or do something like this, right? The rare stories of long-distance miracles suggest to ancient readers that these miracle workers had extraordinary power. For Jesus, the only prerequisite for such miracles is seeker's faith in his power. Distance meant nothing to the God who made distance. It just all that mattered was the heart. If the heart was there, it said, oh, done. Scrap of faith? Yeah, got it. You don't even need a mustard seed. If you had a mustard seed, you can do it yourself. But I just need a little small, little peck, speck of a thing. That's all we got to have. 4:46, his son had been sick, and undoubtedly he had exhausted all the local means at his disposal. Failure of position and money to solve his problem. There was nothing. You know, they seem like big, strong hands, but they don't work. They don't fix the problem. Drove him from Capernaum to the village of Cana, 20, 25 miles away, hoping that the healer would save his son from death. Jesus' address to him, though sharp, was necessary. A faith built only on miraculous signs is not a complete faith. Many you people hesitate to believe in Jesus apart from seeing miraculous signs and wonders. Faith in Jesus is absolutely necessary, but not all believers are given public importance. Not everybody gets miracles, basically. The official was in no position emotionally to argue his case theologically with Jesus. All he could do was plead for mercy, for his child was at the point of death. Jesus' calm reply to the official's desperate request created the crisis. Jesus announced, "You may go, your son will live." If the official really believed that Jesus could make a difference in Capernaum, he must also believe him now in Cana. Okay? In other words, his faith is getting made more explicit. Jesus, is, to use an English phrase, is teasing out the content of his theology. If he believes he can do something miraculous in Cana, then, I mean, when he's in Capernaum, then that same prophet, why would it be restricted to him physically being? You know, as he's drawing out what it means, he's drawing out his theology, thinking, oh, distance might mean nothing to somebody that could do that. So he took Jesus at his word and left. On his way back, the official must have pondered Jesus' promise every step of the journey. Because you know he went away unhappy. Right? You know he said, go your way. And he's got the crisis of faith. And he would have loved to have gotten a little more evidence, a little more confidence. And so he's thinking all the way along. Did I do the right thing? Should I have stayed? Should I have asked one more time? Should I have brought some friends? He's thinking about this all the way through. Okay, so that's our stuff in Cana. We're going to get started on Capernaum for the next 6 minutes. And we're going to start actually with the pictures. That's all we're probably going to have time for here. Because I've got a bunch of slides I want to cover on pictures of Capernaum. Now, there's the Sea of Galilee looking north. So north, south, east, and west. Capernaum is right up here at the north end of the lake. Bethsaida is over here, where two of the other disciples are from. But the thriving fishing village, that's a major trade route, comes through there, goes north. One goes up here to Chorazon. One actually goes across over here. And this is Capernaum. Yeah, you know, yeah, all of those maps are in the front. Every map is in that. Now, these are just a couple of pictures of that area. So here's looking northeast of on the Sea of Galilee. So Capernaum is like right over in here. And this is this is that fertile area of Galilee we're talking around there. So you can see these are beautiful fields, and mountains are over in the distance, but it's not as mountainous as southern Judea is. But Galilee is going to, this is all Galilee. But Capernaum is going to be up at that north end of the lake. There's the north end of the lake zoomed in a little bit. Capernaum is a seaport city right here. It's next to Bethsaida, which is also a thriving community. Mount of Beatitudes, where Jesus would have done the blessed are the meek, blessed are the pure in heart, blessed are the peacemakers, is right over in there on a natural mountain where it's not too tall, but it's just flowing, a gradually descending thing where the acoustics are just awesome. Tabitha is where Peter's fish. They have restaurants there where the tax collectors come to Jesus, comes to Peter and says, does your master not pay the temple tax? And they go to Peter comes to Jesus, and Jesus uses it to teach him. Says, who pays taxes? Do the sons of the kings pay the taxes? Or is it just the subjects? And he said, and who's exempt? Well, the sons are exempt. And he says, well, that's my particular case. I'm actually the son of the king here. But, so we don't give offense, go and throw your net, cast a line into the sea, and take out the first fish you get. And in it, there'll be two coins, which are double the amount. I mean, and go pay the tax for you and me out of the coin of the amount. Well, that particular brand of fish, of course, is famous in Tabitha because they have the restaurant, you know, that sells that fish, special, you know, dishes of that fish, and they have all the little coins on the side, you know. And that's where part of there are two or three places where it occurs, but that may not be right. Tabitha may be the commissioning of Peter. It may be further down here, but it's right up in there that occurs. So you can see where Capernaum is. It's a seacoast town. That's the Mount of Beatitudes. This is a house, so you see the size of the scale. There's a road. So he would have, like, stood up in here, and would have been, this was a valley that goes down and goes back up. It's just a natural amphitheater. And so when he addressed crowds in the 5 and 6 thousand of people, you could have literally hear it over there. There are no electrical noises. There are no hums. There are no sirens. This kind of stuff. Mount of Beatitudes. We're looking at it from the west. Here's the Sea of Galilee over there. And then here's the drawing of Capernaum. Now, one of the healings, Jesus is going to heal Peter's mother-in-law. And they're going to live, they live right there on the pier. And here's this big house here. And that's a drawing of Peter's house, a reconstruction of it. And behind Peter's house is the synagogue in the city. And so after the synagogue service, they would have gone to Peter's house normally to eat and have fellowship and this kind of stuff. But you can see that, you know, these are those four room houses that are built. The trading area is long. There's a waterfront, boats in the piers. And that's the way it would have looked. That's a very big house. Peter's house is a very large house compared to some of these others. A lot of the houses would have been adjoined. They would have shared walls like condos are, where you share a wall in the urban areas. You would have gone in that direction. Here's a shot of Peter's house today, the area, and the synagogue. And where the piers would have been along in here. We're looking now from the north, over toward the Mediterranean Sea. You can't see it in the distance, but Nazareth is like right over those mountains up there. The church has built, the modern church has built this orthogonal church on top of the remains of Peter's house. So when you go there, there's this fancy-looking, space-age-looking church thing that's this orthogonal that's up on stilts above the rubble that's the foundation of Peter's house. So there's a gap. You can walk down in that and look at Peter's house, but the church was built there to keep people from stealing the stones. Here's a little closer shot of that. Okay, so there's the synagogue remains. You can see how close it was. This would have all been, you can see where they're sort of digging stuff up there. This would have been housing up in all these areas, through that. There's another shot of it going close. This is a synagogue. Now, this is not the synagogue of Jesus' day. It's built on top of the synagogue of Jesus' day. This is the Byzantine. So Byzantine is going to be 400 through 800 AD, roughly, is going to be when that's built on top of the rubble. We'll look at the foundation in a minute, but you can see there's that orthogonal church. There's the stilts that is standing on, and under that is the foundation of Peter's house. There's some of those condo foundations. You can see how the rooms are fairly small, but they're built together, as an urban area in the city, with passageways and like a complex. There's a reconstruction of Peter's house at Capernaum. Okay, it's a very large compared to those four-room houses we looked at. It's actually got three courtyards. Here's a courtyard here. There's a courtyard here. There's a courtyard under there. These are the stones. We're looking north. But it's a very large, wealthy house. There was their family was apparently wealthy. There was a very good fishing business for them. They had workers. They had employees. They worked as families with Peter, Andrew, James, and John. Those four disciples and apostles, you know, they're two sets of brothers, and they're all in the fishing business. Now we think that they might have moved here from Bethsaida. All right, there's the synagogue, the Byzantine synagogue at Capernaum today. Okay, and again, that's not at Jesus time, but if you look around the side, the foundation is the basalt. And the basalt is that asphalt kinds of stuff that we have all around in that area. And that's one of the ways they know the difference of age of the architecture. This is just cheaper stuff. This kind of stone would have had to been quarried in and cut out of mountains a little further away. Basalt was just naturally occurring there, rock formations. But that would have been the foundation of the synagogue that Jesus would have actually walked into for the miracle that we'll talk about next week. there's a reconstruction of the first century synagogue that Jesus would have been in. So internally you would have had the post, but you will see you've got almost like like basketball gymnasium seating, you know, where the little bleachers, you know, run along the sides, and you'd sit on either side, and there would be aisle and an entrance, and you would populate it from there. At the other end would have been the sort of like the sanctuary where you would store the scrolls and the seat of Moses where the leader would see, and you know, and you would they would pass you a roll here to read from, like they did Jesus at, you know, in Nazareth, and you'd get up and you'd go stand either where you are or in the nave and do the your reading and teaching. Okay, those are the screens I wanted to show you from this, and when we get back together next week, we'll go into the stuff that occurred, because he heals a mother-in-law here. He heals a demoniac inside the synagogue, but something like 12 of his 30 miracles are done in this town. You know, there's just so much that goes on here because it was a metropolitan hub. You know, you'd go here and word would spread all over everywhere. You know, if it occurred in Capernaum, that's where his headquarters is. A lot of his funding is going to come from here. Both Peter, James, John, and Andrew, they're wealthy fisher families. Salome, who's going to be the mother of James and John, is going to follow Jesus around, be there at the cross, and go be at the resurrection. I mean, they were a wealthy family. They supported him. They're politically ambitious. I mean, she's the one that's going to say, Jesus, would you grant that my sons would sit on the right and the left hand of yours when you come into your imperial kingdom? You know, so, and they sort of put her up to it. Like, go ask Jesus this. Oh, no, he's going to fuss at us if we ask this. You know, come on, Mom, do this for us. You know, and he sees exactly what's going on. You know, and so there's a cute story about that. But they were very dedicated families to the Lord, and churches are built later, are funded by the same families long after the New Testament. They're still funding families for the Christians, that the Messianic Jews that are there in Capernaum. So we'll go through. We have a lot of material to cover on Capernaum because it was such a central thing. The Roman centurion's son, he was amazed at the people of Nazareth at their lack of faith. And he's amazed at the centurion, who's a Gentile, a Roman, at his faith. The contrast could not be stark between good Jewish folk and the Gentiles that they despised. Although they really liked this guy. He built them a synagogue, and he was very supportive of the Jewish population. We have evidence that out of purity, he didn't take the best place in the city to build his barracks and stuff. He actually put it outside the city so he wouldn't cause ritual defilement to the Jews that lived in the city. So there's a depth of conscience in this individual that that perhaps was not particularly normal for a centurion, perhaps. But and I don't want to slur centurions because I don't know a whole lot of them. But the stories are not in their favor generally in the Roman histories, but they're conscientious and trustworthy people. But we'll look at that story because of some of the beautiful elements in it that apply to our life. So it's 8:37, so I'm going to have to cut off here, and we will try to get one more city of the, well, page 21 of 51. So we've only got 30 pages to cover in our last session next week. So come prepared for really fast talking and
gripping.
Yeah, bring it. Yeah, we don't have a third story, so you ain't got to worry about falling out and falling having a race. So let's close in a word of prayer. Lord, we do thank you for you're approachable. That our persistence, Lord, that we can ask you, and even when your response is ambiguous, you know, sometimes you're just sort of teasing that out of us to approach you more. And, because you delight in blessing us. You delight in being with us in our suffering and in our joys and being part of our lives. And we know you're eager about that, but that you will take every opportunity, however small it might be, that when we approach you, to get as much as you can out of it for our good. You'll try to grow our faith. You'll try to develop our love for one another. You'll try to soften habits of resentment and bitterness and perspectives that are not like yours. And you are the only wise God, and you know what you're doing. And we trust you for this. And we do ask, though, Lord, that we would be more persistent in seeking after you and opening up more areas of our life, saying, Lord, I don't know if this is right, but if it's not, please change this. I want to open this up. I know this is an area that that needs work, perhaps, and I'm not sure, but I'll at least offer it up to you for you to work on like the healer does. So bless these sweeties, Lord, for this week, and bring us back safely again next week. And may we walk with you like you walked with us so long ago. For your son's sake, we pray that we would love him more, appreciate him more. We'd see him more in our life. We'd think about him more as he walked among us and what he's trying to do in our life as we go closer together to him and to meeting him. For his sake, we pray. Amen.